Have you got an alibi?
Depends on the exact timing, but probably not. I'm sure the cops are already looking for me.
Problem?
Only temporary. Science is on my side. If her neck was broken by a single blow to her right temple, then her head rotated a little, counterclockwise, which means the punch was thrown by a left-hander. And I'm right-handed. If I had hit her in the right temple, I would have knocked her out, for sure, but I wouldn't have broken her neck. I would have had to do that separately, afterward.
You sure? I used to do this stuff for a living, remember? But will they believe you? Or will they figure you're big enough to have done it with your weak hand?
I'm not going to risk finding out.
You're going to run?
No, I'm going to stick around, but I'm going to have to stay out of their way. Which will slow me down some. A lot, in fact. Which is why I said I've got operational problems.
Can I help?
Reacher smiled. It's good to see you, Hutton. It really is.
How can I help?
My guess is there'll be a cop called Emerson waiting for you after you're done with your deposition. He'll ask you about me. Just play dumb. Just say, I never showed up. You didn't see me, you don't know where I am, all that kind of stuff. She was quiet for a spell.
You're upset. I can tell.
He nodded, rubbed his face like he was washing without water. I don't care much about James Barr. If someone wanted to set him up so he took the punishment he should have taken 14 years ago, that was okay with me. But this thing with the girl is different. It's way out of line. She was just a sweet, dumb kid. She meant no harm.
Hutton was quiet for a moment longer. Are you sure about the threat to Barr's sister?
I don't see any other leverage.
But there's no sign of a threat. As a prosecutor, I couldn't see entering it as a separate charge.
Why else would Barr have done what he did?
Hutton didn't answer. Will I see you later?
I've got a room not far away. I'll be around.
Okay.
Unless I'm already in jail. The waitress came back and they ordered dessert. Reacher asked for more coffee and Hutton got more tea. They kept on talking. Random subjects. Random questions. They had 14 years to catch up on. Helen Roden searched through the 6 cartons of evidence and found a crisp photocopy of a sheet of paper that had been found next to James Barr's telephone. It was as close as he had gotten to a personal phone book. It had 3 numbers on it, written in neat and careful handwriting. 2 were for his sister Rosemary, 1 at her condo and the other at work. The 3rd number was for Mike, the neighborhood guy. Nothing for anyone called Charlie. Helen dialed Mike's number. It rang 6 times and cut to an answering machine. She left her office number and asked for a return call on a matter of great importance. Emerson spent an hour with a sketch artist and came up with a pretty good likeness of Jack Reacher's face. The drawing was then scanned into a computer and colorized. Dirty blonde hair, ice blue eyes, medium to dark tan. Emerson then typed the name and estimated the height at 6'5", the weight at 250, the age between 35 and 45. He put the police department's phone number on the bottom line, then he emailed it all over the place and set the printer to churn out 200 color copies. He told every prowl car driver to take a sheaf and give one to every hotel clerk and barman in town. Then he added, every restaurant, diner, lunch counter, and sandwich shop, too. James Barr's friend Mike called Helen Roden back at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She asked for his address and got him to agree to a face-to-face interview. He said he was home for the rest of the day, so she called a cab and headed out. Mike lived on James Barr's street, 20 minutes from downtown. Barr's house was visible from Mike's front yard. Both houses were similar. All the houses on the street were similar. They were 1950s ranches, long and low. Helen guessed they had all started out identical, but a half-century's worth of adding on and re-roofing and re-siding and ongoing landscaping had made them diverge in appearance. Some looked upmarket, and some still looked basic. Barr's place looked worn, Mike's place looked manicured. Mike himself was a tired 50-something who worked the morning shift at a paint wholesaler. His wife arrived home while Helen was still introducing herself. She was also a tired 50-something. Her name was Tammy, which didn't suit her. She was a part-time dental nurse. She worked two mornings a week for a downtown dentist. She ushered Helen and Mike into the living room and then went away to make coffee. Helen and Mike sat down and started out with an awkward initial silence that lasted minutes.
"So, what can I tell you?"
Mike asked eventually.
"You were Mr. Barr's friend," Helen said.
Mike glanced at the living room door. It was open.
"Just a neighbor. His sister called you a friend."
"We were neighborly.
Some folks might call that friendly. Did you spend time together?"
"We would chat a little if he walked by with his dog."
"About what kind of thing?"
"Our yards. If he was decorating, he'd ask me about paint. I asked him who fixed his driveway, things like that."
"Baseball?"
Mike nodded.
"We would talk about that."
Tammy came in with three cups of coffee on a tray. There was cream and sugar and a small plate of cookies with them and three paper napkins. She put the tray on a low table and sat down next to her husband.
"Help yourself," she said.
"Thank you," Helen said.
"Thank you very much."
They all served themselves, and there was silence in the room.
"Were you ever in Mr. Barr's house?"
Helen asked. Mike glanced at his wife.
"Once or twice," he said.
"They weren't friends," Tammy said.
"Was it a surprise that he did what he did?"
"Yes, it was," said Tammy.
"So you don't need to feel bad about mixing with him before. It wasn't something that anyone could have predicted. These things are always a surprise. Neighbors never know." "You're trying to get him off."
"Actually, I'm not," Helen said. "But there's a new theory that he didn't act alone. I'm just trying to make sure that the other man gets punished, too."
"It wasn't Mike," Tammy said.
"I don't think it was," Helen said.
"Really?"
"Not for a moment. Not now that I've met him. But whoever the other man is, you or Mike might know him, or have heard about him, or even seen him coming and going."
"Barr didn't really have friends," Mike said.
"Nobody?"
"Not that he spoke about to me. He lived with his sister until she moved out. I guess that was enough for him."
"Does the name Charlie mean anything to you?"
Mike just shook his head.
"What did Mr. Barr do when he had a job?"
"Well, I don't know. He hasn't worked for years."
"I seen a man over there," Tammy said.
"When?"
"Now and then. Occasionally. He comes and goes, all times of the day and night, like a friend would."
"For how long?"
"Ever since we moved here. I spend more time at home than Mike does, so I notice more."
"When was the last time you saw this man?"
"Last week, I think. A couple of times."
"Friday?"
"No, earlier. Tuesday and Wednesday, maybe."
"What does he look like?"
"Well, he's small. He's got funny hair, black like hog bristles."
"Charlie," Helen thought. Eileen Hutton walked three fast blocks south from the Marriott and arrived at the courthouse at 3:58 exactly. Alex Roden's secretary came down to escort her up to the third floor. Depositions were taken in a large conference room because most witnesses brought their own lawyers and court reporters with them. But Hutton was on her own. She sat down alone on one long side of a large table and smiled as a microphone was placed in front of her and a video camera was focused on her face. Then Roden came in and introduced himself. He brought a small team with him, an assistant, his secretary, a court reporter with her machine.
"Would you state your full name and title for the record?" he asked.
Hutton looked at the camera.
"Eileen Ann Hutton, Brigadier General, Judge Advocate General's Corps, United States Army."
"I hope this won't take long," Roden said.
"It won't."
And it didn't. Roden was trawling in a sea he hadn't charted. He was like a man in a darkened room. All he could do was dart around randomly and hope he bumped into something. After six questions, he realized he was never going to. He asked,
"How would you characterize James Barr's military service?"
"Exemplary without being exceptional."
"Was he ever in trouble?"
"Not to my knowledge."
"Did he ever commit a crime?"
"Not to my knowledge."
"Are you aware of recent events in this city?"
Yes, I am.
Is there anything in James Barr's past that might shed light on the likelihood, or otherwise, of his having been involved in those events?
Not to my knowledge.
Finally, he asked, is there any reason why the Pentagon might be more aware of James Barr than any other veteran?
Not to my knowledge.
So at that point, Alex Roden gave up. Okay. Thank you, General Hutton. Helen Roden walked 30 yards and stood on the street for a moment outside James Barr's house. It had police tape across the entryway and a plywood sheet nailed over the broken front door. It looked forlorn and empty. There was nothing to see. So she used her cell phone to call a cab and had it take her to the county hospital. It was after 4 o'clock in the afternoon when she arrived, and the sun was in the west. It lit up the white concrete building with pale shades of orange and pink. She rode up to the 6th floor and signed in with the Board of Corrections and found the tired 30-year-old doctor and asked him about James Barr's condition. The doctor didn't really answer. He wasn't very interested in James Barr's condition. That was clear. So Helen just walked past him and opened Barr's door. Barr was awake. He was still handcuffed to the cot. His head was still clamped. His eyes were open and he was staring at the ceiling. His breathing was low and slow, and the heart monitor was beeping less than once a second. His arms were trembling slightly, and his handcuffs were rattling against the bed frame. Quiet, dull, metallic sounds.
Who's there?
Helen stepped close and leaned into his field of view.
Are they looking after you?
I have no complaints.
Tell me about your friend, Charlie.
Is he here?
No, he's not here.
Did Mike come?
I don't think they allow visitors, just lawyers and family.
Barr said nothing.
Are those your only friends, Mike and Charlie?
I guess. And Mike's more of a neighbor.
What about Jeb Oliver?
Who?
He works at the auto parts store?
I don't know him.
Are you sure?
Barr's eyes moved and his lips pursed, like a man searching his memory, trying to be helpful, desperate for approval.
I'm sorry. I never heard of him.
Do you use drugs?
No, never. I wouldn't do that.
He was quiet for a beat.
Truth is, I don't really do much of anything. I just live. That's why this whole thing makes no sense to me. I spent 14 years in the world. Why would I throw it all away now?
Tell me about Charlie.
We hang out. We do stuff.
With guns?
A little bit.
Where does Charlie live?
I don't know.
How long have you been friends?
5 years, maybe 6.
And you don't know where he lives?
He never told me.
He's been to your place.
So?
You never went to his place.
He came to mine instead.
Do you have his phone number?
He just shows up here and there, now and then.
Are you close?
Close enough.
How close, exactly?
We get along.
Well enough to tell him what happened 14 years ago?
Barr didn't answer, just closed his eyes.
Did you tell him?
Barr said nothing.
I think you told him.
Barr didn't confirm or deny it.
I'm surprised that a man doesn't know where his friend lives, especially a friend as close as I think Charlie is.
I didn't push it. I was lucky to have a friend at all. I didn't want to ruin it with questions.
Eileen Hutton got up from Alex Roden's deposition table and shook hands all around. Then she stepped out to the corridor and came face to face with a guy she assumed was the cop called Emerson, the one Reacher had warned her about. He confirmed it by handing her a card with his name on it.
Can we talk? He asked.
About what?
About Jack Reacher.
What about him?
You know him, am I right?
I knew him 14 years ago. When did you last see him?
14 years ago, she said. We were in Kuwait together. Then he shipped out somewhere.
Or I did, I can't remember.
You didn't see him today.
He's in Indiana?
He's in town. Right here, right now.
Small world.
How did you get here?
I flew into Indianapolis and rented a car.
Staying overnight?
Do I have a choice?
Where?
The Marriott.
Reacher killed a girl last night.
Are you sure?
He's our only suspect.
That would be very unlike him.
Call me if you see him. The station house number is on my card, and my direct extension, and my cell phone.
Why would I see him? Like you said, it's a small world.
A police black and white crawled north through the building rush hour traffic, past the gun store, past the barber shop, any style, $7. Then it eased right and turned into the motor court. The cop in the passenger seat got out and walked to the office, gave the clerk a flyer, laid it flat on the counter and swiveled it around and slid it across.
Call us if this guy shows up, okay?
The cop said.
He's already here, the clerk said. But his name's Hefner, not Reacher. I put him in room 8 last night.
The cop stood still.
Is he in there now?
I don't know. He's come and gone a few times.
How long did he book for?
He paid one night, but he didn't give the key back yet.
So he's planning to be here again tonight?
I guess. Unless he's already here.
Unless.
The cop stepped back to the office door, signaled his partner. His partner shut the motor down and locked the car and walked over.
Roommate, false name, the first cop said.
In there now?
We don't know.
So let's find out.
They took the clerk with them. They made him stand well back. They drew their weapons and knocked on room 8's door. No response. They knocked again. No response.
Got a master key?
The first cop asked. The clerk handed him a key. The cop put it in the lock, gently, one-handed, turned it slowly, opened the door a half inch and paused, and then smashed it all the way open and stepped inside. His partner stepped in right behind him. Their guns traced left and right and up and down, fast and random and tense. The room was empty. Nothing in there at all, except a forlorn little sequence of bathroom items lined up on a shelf above the sink. A new pack of throwaway razors, open, one used. A new can of shaving foam with dried bubbles around the nozzle. A new tube of toothpaste, twice squeezed.
This guy travels light, the first cop said.
But he hasn't checked out, that's for sure.
Which means he's coming back.